Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call and talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, and I'm here with my co-host, Ron Meniza. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can call us at 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch ND. So we got a bunch of stuff going on. First of all, we've got some news for you, and that's that there looks like there could be a second flu wave. So there's concerns about the second flu wave, that the big strain of flu, influenza A, is pretty much on its way down, but there's a second type B that's on the rise still. So they're thinking that the flu season around here could go through as long as June. Yeah. Up to June, or maybe a little bit into June. And this is something that I've been seeing in recent years, that when people come in sick with colds and with flus, I'm seeing it through June that we really only get a break. It's getting to the point of the whole winter in July joke, that we see a little dip in colds and flus in July and August. And then as soon as people get back into school, people at least start getting colds.
I don't like that joke.
Yeah, I know, right? Mm. But they're talking about this potential rise of the flu type B, and the general medical community is still recommending that people get flu shots. And however, that the type B flu is usually not as severe as type A. So, and again, the general medical community is still recommending you can still get a flu shot if you want to. You know, and I'm equivocal about the flu shot, as you probably know. And what I say is, it's your own decision about whether you want to get a flu shot or not. It may or may not protect you from the flu. Just realize that you, just because you get a flu shot doesn't mean you won't get the flu, which means you still have to do all of your best practices. You have to still wash your hands really well, wash your hands regularly for at least 15 seconds, and or use hand sanitizer. It's a good idea to use a neti pot. And gargle. You can also use nasal sprays. The nasal sprays I like have either silver in them, or they have xylitol and saline in them. Salt water kills a lot of stuff, so does xylitol. Xylitol and salt water will kill viruses. They also kill bacteria, anything that's sitting in your nose. And of course, the allergy season is coming up, and with the pollen coming out, people are starting to have their allergy symptoms. And so that means that you're going to be a little bit more congested. So if something comes along and gets inside your nose, it's going to tend to congest you more. You're going to be more likely to have symptoms, and there's more likely to be a place in your nose where a flu virus can set up. So you're still not exempt. It's still a good idea to practice healthy habits. Don't eat too much sugar. Get plenty of rest. Do your washing. Cleaning your nose and gargling every day is a really good idea, especially if you're out in the public a lot, especially if you're around children a lot, if you're in school or you have children or you're anywhere near kids, of course, if you're in the medical field, and if you're in an office where, you know, a lot of people touch a lot of stuff, just think about the idea that the flu season is not over yet. Now, one of the nice things that's happening is high vitamin C foods are coming up, and they're not just coming from Chile anymore. So you're getting berries now from Mexico and even Florida. And this is a great time to start eating strawberries. The strawberries are in season. They're not in season here, but they're in season further south, and they're high in vitamin C. So getting in foods that are high in vitamin C are going to be helpful. Foods that are high in beta carotene, precursors to vitamin A. Vitamin A is a great antiviral, so this is a good time to be eating your leafy greens and your brightly colored vegetables, your carrots, even some squash and sweet potatoes to get your vitamin A, but especially those leafy greens, because a lot of the local growers are able to grow their greens now, and you're going to be able to get precursors to vitamin A, which are great antivirals.
And if you've been playing the grocery store route all winter long, oh boy, what a difference.
Yeah.
Huge difference.
Yeah. So going to the, going to the
big,
farmer's
big endorsement for our local leafy greeners.
So other things you can do, it's still a good idea to take that elderberry syrup. Elderberry syrup has been studied to fight and kill the flu virus. So there's good studies on it. There's studies in Israel. There's studies that you can find on PubMed in reputable medical journals that talk about elderberry killing flu virus. And it's much more pleasant than a vaccination. And you can take, depending on how concentrated the elder syrup, we're talking a quarter to a teaspoon a day of this very pleasant tasting syrup that can help to prevent you from getting the flu. It's really worth doing. I have a bottle of elderberry syrup in the bathroom at my office for all of my staff to just take whenever they feel like it. So elder syrup and good practices to prevent viruses, it's really a good idea to do that at least through June. And then July and August, you're going to be outside getting a lot of sun, hopefully a lot of produce. You might be able to lighten up a little bit, but maybe not, depending on who you work with. But I am at the point where I am seeing colds and flus through June, a little bit of a break in July and August, and as soon as people get back to school, September, I start seeing colds again. It's just all year, almost all year now. You get a little bit of a break, and that's it. It's unfortunate. And so, like I said, you can get the vaccination if you want to, but it doesn't necessarily protect you. It might offer you a little bit of extra protection, but you still have to do all of the other things. All right, so that's the deal with the flu. So here we are with more microorganisms that we don't really want to know about, unfortunately. So let's now talk about something else that's been in the news lately. Yay, antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Oh boy.
Yeah.
I know, right?
Yeah.
So antibiotic-resistant bacteria they're more likely to be in the environment these days. If you go into the hospital, you're more likely to. Hospitals are very sanitary places, and you'd think that the reason that you could get antibiotic resistant bacteria in the hospital is because they're not sanitary places. But that's not it. It's because they're always cleaning, and so the general environment favors disinfectant resistant bacteria, and that's what happens.
They kill everything there.
I know. That's the issue. So there's a few different bacteria. There's this one that carbapenem resistant Enterobacteriaceae, so CRE, which can kill. It's deadly if it gets into your bloodstream, urinary tract, or lungs. There's also MRSA, which is methicillin resistant Staph aureus, and so these unfortunately are in the environment, and some people can be carriers and not get sick from it, but they can spread it. So still, if you want to protect yourself from, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, you still want to do things like practicing good hygiene. Just like I said before, the neti pot, gargling, washing your hands regularly, and eating well, having good proportion of fermentables on hand, good probiotics and fermented foods, those are all going to help your immune system. So there's interesting things that can help with antibiotic resistant bacteria. Okay, one of them is essential oils. People are very excited about essential oils, and there are various essential oils that have actually been studied. I am looking at a study in Open Microbiology Journal called Essential Oils, A New Horizon in Combating Bacterial Antibiotic Resistance, where they did studies on combining essential oils or studying whether essential oils can go after various bacteria. They tried rosemary essential oil against Staph aureus, as well as lycopus, I'm not actually sure what the common name for that herb. There's a whole bunch of essential oils that they checked. Mormortica tarantia, which is bitter orange, is effective against MRSA. One of the mints is effective against E. coli. And there's something called Ternera ulmifolia, which is effective against MRSA. So the whole bunch of essential oils. Pomegranate is also effective against MRSA. They did some combinations with antibiotics against various bacteria. So they did oregano with fluoroquinolone. So fluoroquinolone would be like your ciprofloxacin, your levoquin, your moxifloxacin. So oregano plus the fluoroquinolones, as well as oregano plus doxycycline, and also something called lincomycin and Maquindox. They tested that against E. coli, and they all enhanced each other's activity. They found, eugenol, you can get eugenol from cloves and from cinnamon, and they combined that with vancomycin, which is a very broad-spectrum antibiotic, and also with beta-lactams, like the penicillins, and all of the Escherichia species, a couple of Escherichia species, E. coli and E. aerogenes, both were killed by that combination, as well as a number of other bacteria. So there's a number of studies that have been done on various essential oils. Oregano is one. Oregano is a big one, and I use oregano for a bunch of different ones. There's also Pelargonium graveolens, which was combined with norfloxacin. Pelargonium is very interesting. You might see that in the health food stores as umka. And umka, umka is used, you can take that syrup for colds. It's a good immune tonic. And if you have a cold, it's something that can go after viruses. So that's a nice one. But oregano oil goes after a lot of different things. It's really interesting. And I found some other things too. Berberines. So berberines are one of my favorite go-to antimicrobials. So berberines are compounds. They're very powerful antimicrobial compounds. And berberines have been studied in the ability to kill MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. So berberines are... We use berberines for a lot of different things. It's like a great natural antibiotic. And berberines are extracted from plants like golden seal. The berberines are found in golden seal, golden thread. They're also found in, guess what, berberis, and Oregon grape and Mahonia, Oregon grape is it's not endangered. When you go to the Northwest, it's everywhere. It's very easy to find. So if you're not feeling well, you can just go out in the woods and pull up some Oregon grape and chew on the root. I mean, it's everywhere, really. You go in the woods, anywhere, like in Portland. You don't have to even be outside of Portland. You go in Portland, in any woodsy area, and there's going to be some Oregon grape growing. It just grows everywhere.
Has to be Oregon grape? Can't be Connecticut grape?
Oh, boy. So what do you mean by Connecticut grape?
I don't know.
Are you joking?
Possibly.
Okay. So, yes, it has to be Oregon, the plant called Oregon grape. It has to be have berberis in the genus name. So
it's not actually grape.
It is Oregon grape.
Okay.
It's not Vitis vinifera, if that's what you mean. Is that what you mean?
I don't know. Is that what I mean?
Vitis vinifera is grapes that you make wine out of.
Yes.
Or that you eat, you know, your red grapes, green grapes,
correct,
black grapes.
Correct.
So no.
Okay.
It's not even related.
Okay.
No, Oregon grape is it's a low growing shrub, and the leaves, so you know what holly leaves look like?
Yeah.
Yeah. So holly leaves are kind of bent and they have spiny things sticking out. So Oregon grape leaves look kind of like that, except they're flatter and the little spiny things are pointing all in the same direction. And they grow close to the ground. And they don't grow as big and bushy as, well, I guess that may not be true in all cases. But they tend to grow closer to the ground. And, of course, if you pull the root up, it's got this doctrine of signatures, very bright yellow root, and it's called the doctrine. It follows the doctrine of signatures because it's kind of the color of bile. And Oregon grape is a great biliary tonic. It's a great tonic for your liver and your biliary system. So, So it grows very close to the ground, and then the berries. I guess they kind of look like grape, like tiny little grapes, but they don't taste like tiny little grapes. They're sort of icky and, I mean, you can eat them, but they're kind of icky and bitter.
That's why
it's called Oregon grape, because it does in fact have little tiny fruits. But they're not something you would want to go out and harvest like the myriad numbers of blackberries you can get in the Northwest, where, you know, people actually have to beat back the blackberry bushes from growing on their property. It's an invasive species. a delicious species. And, you know, when we get blackberries on the power lines here, the blackberries are nothing compared to what they do in Oregon. They're like the wild blackberries are big, fat, juicy things that you can actually eat yourself sick on while you're picking them and then take them home and make your jam and pies and throw them in your smoothies and freeze them and a thousand other things. And they just keep growing and growing. They're pretty amazing. So, but anyway, berberines are something that kills antibiotic resistant bacteria. We also, if somebody gets a case of C. diff, they might get given, an intense antibiotic, but you can also give them berberines. Berberines will help. Berberines can help kill C. diff. The cool thing about berberines is there isn't one berberine. There's a number of different compounds that are berberines. So it's much harder for bacteria to develop antibiotic resistance to berberines, as well as to most plant species, because there's lots of different constituents when you're using a plant. So it's harder for the microflora to figure out how to get around the mechanism by which the berberines are killing them. So there's and there's different mechanisms by which they do that. So that's kind of exciting. Berberines are something you can get in a health food store. You can certainly get it from your friendly local naturopathic physician. Then probiotics. So the neat thing about probiotics is probiotics are a double-edged sword. So that's interesting. Why would that be? It's if you think about it, it's pretty obvious. So here's the deal. Probiotics are wonderful for your immune system because they make immune compounds. They make compounds that kill unfriendly bacteria. They set up an acidic environment, which a lot of anaerobic bacteria, your harmful bacteria are anaerobic, and anaerobic bacteria tend to do damage. And so your aerobic bacteria tend to form acids, and the acids that they form tend to kill our anaerobic bacteria, and your MRSAs and your things like that are going to be anaerobic. So they're helpful in that way. And they make compounds that help to stimulate your immune system, and they crowd out bad guys. The problem with them is that when you get a bunch of bacteria together, doesn't matter if they're good or bad. They don't care if they're good or bad. They exchange genetic material. So one of the unfortunate things is the genetic material that causes a bacterium to be antibiotic resistant can be exchanged with a probiotic bacteria. So you can exchange, for example, a MRSA bacteria could theoretically take some of its antibiotic resistant genetic material and exchange it with a Lactobacillus acidophilus bacterium. And now the Lactobacillus acidophilus bacterium has antibiotic resistant properties and can confer those genes on other staph and strep and unfriendly bacteria that can be potentially unfriendly. So probiotics are, you want to have probiotics on board. If you have a preponderance of probiotic bacteria in your body, your immune system's going to work better. Your digestive system's going to work better. You're going to have better immunity. You're on the whole going to crowd out unfriendly bacteria. So I wouldn't stop drinking that kefir. One of my favorite foods to get good live foods to get good bacteria into a person is kefir, and their vegan components. They're very good. And the nice thing about kefir, of course, is that the wide variety of probiotic bacteria that are found in the kefir and the fact that they persist. Whereas if you eat yogurt, yogurt's very good. And, you know, if you're not resistant to yogurt, or if you don't have intolerance to eating yogurt as a food, yogurt is very good for you, and it has probiotic bacteria, but the probiotic bacteria that are in yogurt don't tend to stay around. You have to keep eating it. And that's why you have to keep eating foods that have probiotic in it. When back before people figured out that they could ferment stuff, the way the hunter-gatherers worked was they obviously ate probiotic. They had to, but they were eating it all the time because there were no pesticides. There was no farming. They would just eat, they would eat animals, and they would eat plant matter, and the plant matter had bacteria on it, and that's how they got their probiotics. There are probiotics in the soil. So good quality soil, organic vegetables and produce that's being grown with care to the soil is going to have good microorganisms on it. How do you make sauerkraut? You take a cabbage, you cut it up, You bang on it a little bit, put a little salt on it, and then you cover it up and you wait. So how could you do that? Then it turns into sauerkraut, right? You didn't put any culture in it. So, no, it's because the sauerkraut has Lactobacillus brevis living on it. So, you know, there's probiotics living on healthful produce. So it's good stuff. So I would say that on the whole, you want to make sure you're doing your probiotic bacteria in general, being aware that some probiotics could exchange genetic material with unfriendly bacteria, and that, quite honestly, if you're eating a large variety of produce, you're going to be eating a lot of fiber. The fiber is going to promote healthy bacterial growth. You're going to be killing, if you do have any stray antibiotic-resistant bacteria that come in, the essential oils and the good quality plant foods that you're eating, as well as the probiotics and the fiber, and your regularity are going to make it so that those things don't hang around. So making friends with good flora on the whole is going to be a good thing. And eating a healthy diet on the whole, because that supports a good immune system, and that supports healthy bacteria living in your body. And also, again, essential oils, like we talked about, using actual concentrated essential oils will kill microorganisms. But when you eat good quality produce, you're getting essential oils. When you eat any produce, there's going to be some essential oils that are antimicrobial. That's just the plant's defense. So that was interesting. So I was concerned about that because that was in the news. Oh, boy.
So the big growing threat here with the antibiotic resistant nightmare bacteria, that's because we have so much antibiotics in our food.
That's part of why that's happening. We have a lot of exposure to antibiotics, right? So
it's getting thinned out.
Well, what happens is, if you're exposed to antibiotics, every time you're exposed to antibiotics, what happens is, when you take an antibiotic, so say you have a sore throat and somebody says, okay, you have strep, here, take this antibiotic. Mm-hmm. What's happening is that, so say you're given a Z-Pak, you're given azithromycin, right? So you take the azithromycin, and the azithromycin is going to kill a lot of the bacteria, but it's not going to kill 100% of them, just because it can't. It can't possibly get to all of the bacteria. But what you're doing is, you're giving your immune system a leg up, and your immune system's going to do the rest of it. Your nice neutrophils are going to come in and say, uh-uh. If they've overgrown, and when you put an antimicrobial substance in, then you're just giving your immune system some help, and your immune system presumably is going to take care of the rest. The problem is, every time you expose a bunch of bacteria to an antibiotic, there are going to be some bacteria that are resistant to that antibiotic genetically. And so they're not going to die. So then they can go ahead and exchange genetic information with other bacteria, and they can hang around. Now, if you have a healthy immune system, your immune system may kill those antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Also, if you eat a really healthy diet that includes a wide variety of produce, as I said, produce has probiotic, it has essential oils in it, it has antioxidants, has all kinds of things that support your immune system. So the bad guy bacteria are going to be kept at bay, even if that's going on. But the more you're exposed to antibiotics, the more opportunity there is to kill off other strains of bacteria, the more the antibiotic-resistant bacteria are going to flourish, and the more you're going to have around. And that's how that happens. So people are exposed to antibiotics. They can be exposed to antibiotics in dairy products and in meats and poultry. Although poultry, as I understand, in the United States, you're not allowed to use antibiotics in poultry anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
That's good.
But you have to be careful of farm-raised fish, and you have to be careful of other kinds of meat. But that's where people are getting it from. When antibiotics are given to cattle, antibiotics are given to cattle to help them to grow faster. They find that they grow faster if they have antibiotics on board. So you have to be careful of that. So if you're not buying grass-fed, antibiotic-free beef, and you're just getting it on sale at the grocery store, you may be consuming antibiotics all the time. And so, yes, that's where part of the exposure to antibiotics happens. And to some extent, if you have cattle that have been fed antibiotics and then milked, you could be getting it in the milk.
Milk seems to be a big one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, or other milk products, too. So right. Now we're not just talking milk. We're talking butter. We're talking cheese. Right. We're talking yogurt.
Right. So you have to be careful about your dairy products and make sure that they were that they came from cows that were not given antibiotics. Yeah, that's definitely.
And there's more and more of that available these days.
Right.
So
yes.
It's not really a difficult thing to do.
There's definitely.
Although it is a more expensive thing to do.
Right. So there are definitely. But that's one thing that it might be worth it to do. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I would think.
Yeah. All right. So now I'm going to go on to something that's dear to Ron's heart, which is coffee. So there was something in the news about coffee. I had the news on, and they said, there's a toxic compound in coffee. And I looked at it and said, I get points for this. It's going to be acrylamides. And then they said, it's the acrylamides in the coffee. I'm like, okay, so I'm right. Okay.
I gave her a high five.
Right. I got a high five for that. It's like when I get the Jeopardy question right before they say the answer.
Yeah, you get high fives for that.
Yeah, or if we're watching a medical program and I say, oh, they're going to test him for this, or he probably has this. And I get it. I say it before they say it on the TV. And I'm like, oh, you were right. Some bizarre, I'm like, oh, he has this. And, he has hemochromatosis. Or why didn't they test him for hemochromatosis? We tested him for hemochromatosis. Oh, there you go. Just like Howe said, it's never lupus. All right. That's an obtuse, long ago reference.
Yes.
Okay. So acrylamides. Acrylamides is they're classified. The U.S. federal government doesn't classify acrylamide as a carcinogen when it's in food. It is classified as a potential occupational carcinogen by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. So if you get it on your skin in your workplace, that's bad. But if there's a little bit in your coffee, that's not considered to be as much of a big deal as long as the acrylamide wasn't intentionally added to the coffee, which is not done. Nobody would do that.
No, so it's part of the process, is it not?
It's part of, yes, it happens as part of the roasting process. Mm-hmm. It is a significant source of acrylamide exposure for adults, but what they found is that, like in the studies that where they tested people's levels of acrylamide consumption, it's a very small factor in the increase of cancer, which doesn't mean you should eat a lot of foods that are high in acrylamides. So acrylamides, unfortunately, they're a potential carcinogen. And if you're concerned about it, there's things you can do to help to reduce acrylamide content if you're a coffee drinker. And so the darker the roast, the less acrylamide is present. So that's interesting. So if you like your darker roasts.
Yay, dark roast. Right. Love dark roast. That's
so
me.
If you're a French roast person versus a breakfast blend, the breakfast blends are going to have more acrylamides.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even care for breakfast blend.
Another reason why you should only drink dark coffee.
Yeah. Well, all right. But well, some people don't like it.
I know they don't because they think it's bitter and nasty.
So raw acrylamides also are not in raw green coffee beans. So if you're, doing your green coffee bean extract, because there are products out there that have green coffee bean extract in it for the chlorogenic acid, which is supposedly helpful for fat loss. So if you're drinking green coffee bean extract, there's some of those, they're classing them as, wait for it, new age drinks. So, and they have a little bit of caffeine in them. The caffeine, sometimes it's from white tea and sometimes it's from green coffee bean. And green coffee bean extract doesn't have acrylamide in it. So don't worry about that if that's what's going on for you. And so drinks at the popular, there's certain drinks, the refreshers at the popular local cafe. Have green coffee bean extract in them. You don't need to worry about that, nor in the new agey drinks. Okay, but acrylamide is produced from roasting, and it's part of the process when you roast things that have proteins and carbohydrates in them. And so when you when you char stuff, you get acrylamides too. And so French fries are a source of acrylamides. But however, if you the longer you roast coffee, the less acrylamides you will find. That's what happens. So they form during the early stages of roasting, and in the later stages, it's broken down. So that's how that works. And then there's different beans, Arabica versus Robusta beans. But I don't know who uses Robusta beans. Most of the time you see places. Most places and most popular coffees use Arabica beans.
Right.
Just the roast. And so I don't know where you get Robusta beans. But all right. But so just if you're concerned about acrylamides, make sure whatever coffee you're buying, it's Arabica, not Robusta. So by the way, I have an article here that suggests why there's so much more caffeine in Starbucks coffee. And the suggestion is not that they add more caffeine to it. It's that they just pack more coffee in. When they make their roasts, they just pack a lot more coffee into the machine when they're brewing it for you.
So they're just putting more beans in.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're getting a 16-ounce coffee, you're going to get like 330 milligrams of caffeine, which is more than, that's like twice as much as your average cup of coffee, and you're going to feel it. And their decaf is not 100% decaf, because I can attest to that being a slow metabolizing CYP1A2 gal. Yeah. So
anyway, there's, of course, there's people out there is why you can, with the sites that say why you can stop freaking out about the acrylamides in your coffee.
Yeah.
And that's because obviously this has made big press, so people are all worried about it. But
yeah.
I'm trying to figure out just how much coffee one has to drink to be concerned.
Well, over time, also, if you keep your coffee around, the longer you have your coffee, I mean, if your coffee is getting old, the amounts decrease. So when you've roasted your coffee, and this is in roasted coffee, but if you keep your coffee roasted, if it's in a bag, it's the expiration date is going to be 10 months out.
But it doesn't taste as good.
That's if it's in a vacuum sealed bag.
Right.
Obviously, if it's not in a vacuum sealed bag, you're going to.
Yeah, once you've opened it up, you've got
to. You're not going to like it as much. That's right.
Yeah.
But after a while, the amounts of acrylamide goes down. So your antioxidant. So you're not going to have. So the other thing that goes down is the antioxidant values. So your ORAC values, which is that's a measure of antioxidant levels, that goes down too, over 6 months. It's like hit like by half. So the longer you keep coffee, the less benefit you get from it. But also the less acrylamides you're going to have.
Right.
Okay, and then brewed versus espresso. So, mm-hmm. And they did the study on the Swedish women. Swedish women, definitely the highest level of acrylamides came from coffee. And they had higher levels of acrylamides in their bodies. And they did a study of over 43,000 women. And 667 out of those over 43,000 women got breast cancer. That's about 1.5%. And they scrutinized everybody's lifestyle and dietary habits. They got 54% of their acrylamides from coffee, 12 from fried potatoes, and 9 from crisp bread. So most of the acrylamides were coming from coffee. So I don't know if you would say then that if you have a risk of breast cancer, do you want to, if you're going to drink coffee, do you want to make sure that it's dark roast? Do you want to, reduce your acrylamide exposure?
Aren't there a number of other exposures that would give you breast cancer, though?
Sure. So the other thing about the Swedish women is how they drank their coffee. So in the U.S., you have less acrylamide exposure because in the U.S., we do this funny thing. We drink drip-filtered coffee. So guess what? When you drink drip-filtered coffee, less acrylamides. So you espresso and French press people, oopsie, you're going to get more acrylamides.
I don't do that. Yeah.
Yeah. So French press, you're going to get more acrylamides.
Oh, well.
Yeah. So Right, and espresso as well, because you're not filtering it in the same way. There's things that are not going to be filtered out. So those filters, those coffee filters, are going to filter out some of those acrylamides. It's kind of interesting. So then there's low acrylamide, there's low acrylamide coffee filters, coffee brands, and then there's higher acrylamide coffee brands. And it really depends on what you like. So a few of the low acrylamide, the lowest acrylamide coffee brand is Uban, 100% Colombian, just so you know. That's the lowest tested. Hills Brothers is pretty low as well, and it goes up depending on what brand you get. It's interesting. So per dry powder and in parts per billion, the Uban was the lowest, and then brands like Folgers and Starbucks Columbia Ground was sort of in the middle, and the Starbucks House Blend. So they have differing numbers of acrylamides, and then the highest numbers of acrylamides. The one that's the winner for being the highest in acrylamides is this French Market restaurant Blend Coffee and Chicory. I wonder if the reason that that's the highest in acrylamides is because of the chicory in there. The chicory has a lot of carbohydrate, so when you roast carbohydrates with proteins, that's when you're more likely to get acrylamides. And a lot of these, and a lot of the coffees that have high acrylamides are instant. But there were a few that weren't. But your Folgers Classic Instant Roast has a fair bit. So does Taster's Choice. So a lot of the ones that tended to be the lowest were, you know, grinds from coffee beans and, you know, darker roasts. That's what you find. So here's after brewing. So this is parts per million before brewing. That's in the amount in powder. So after you go ahead and brew it, then the acrylamides go way, way down. So if you get it at the 7-Eleven, or you make Cafe Bustelo, or you make your Folgers or Safeway, now we're talking single digits. It's very, very low. The only ones in the double digits were Folgers and Dunkin' Donuts, and it's still in the very low single digits. It's like 8 to 10 parts per million. So how concerning is this? It's hard to say. So there's going to be more acrylamides in in terms of acrylamides, if you're worried about acrylamides, coffee is not actually the thing to worry about. The thing to worry about is fried potatoes, is French fries, and things like graham crackers, and any deep fried chips. Chips are going to be more likely to have acrylamides in them. Here's sweet potato chips from Blue Mesa Grill. They're really high in acrylamides. So you're much more likely to get your acrylamides from potato chips, from French fries, and from things like graham crackers. Things that have a lot of carbohydrate in them and then are baked or roasted. They're usually fried. So that's actually more concerning than coffee. So if you're worried about acrylamides, my advice is don't worry about coffee. It's be more concerned about eating things like potato chips and French fries and cookies, cookies from a box.
Did you hear the sigh of relief for me?
Sigh of relief, yeah. I don't know that it's a super concern.
No.
All right. Wow. So we used up a lot of time there. That's very interesting. Ooh, so let's go on to talk about for a minute why coffee is good for you, which is a nice thing to always talk about. Because we're talking about coffee anyway, we can just review why coffee is good for you. It can make you smart. Makes Ron smart. Or the lack thereof makes him, never mind.
We won't go there.
You know that coffee is the most commonly consumed psychoactive substance in the world. And what it does, it blocks an inhibitory neurotransmitter called adenosine. And when you block adenosine, you get increased neuronal firing. So neurotransmitters, your catecholamines, your dopamine and your epinephrine, get more excited. They're more on board, and they increase alertness and awareness and even pleasure. So that's how it works. It blocks this adenosine, and when you block the adenosine inhibits neurotransmitter firing, so you have more upregulation of things like dopamine and epinephrine. So you're more alert, you're more aware, and you're happier. Coffee, there's studies that show, and these can be equivocal, but caffeine helps to raise your metabolic rate. It stimulates the central nervous system. It increases the oxidation of free fatty acids and mobilizes fatty acids from the fat tissues. There's a couple of references for that. And it can increase exercise performance by 11 to 12% on the average. Now, I know that there's some controversy in the bicycle world about how much caffeine you can use. Is there?
There is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do as far as a limit goes on that.
Right.
But they are talking about putting a larger limit on it. And
yeah.
Which is going to just confuse things.
It's definitely a performance-enhancing substance.
I agree.
So you feel, and when you have caffeine on board, you feel better. I notice for me, so if I have caffeine on board when I'm working out, I'm looking at my heart. I have a readout that's showing me what my heart rate is. So when I look at my heart rate, I find that when I have a reasonable amount of caffeine on board that makes me feel good, that I will... look at my heart rate, and I will feel better at higher heart rates than I do if I don't have caffeine on board. So, you know, a good working heart rate for me, where I'm working pretty hard, is my, I don't know if I'm in zone three, zone four. Say I'm at 145 beats a minute. 145 beats a minute for me is not, I mean, I know 145 for you is that's pretty high, but for me it's not. That like we were out on a nasty hill the other day, and I got up to over 170, and I was working quite hard, but I can sustain 170 for a little bit. But that's, I'm working very, very hard at that point. But 145 is a good moderate heart rate for me, where I'm that I can hold for a while, and that's probably what we would call in workout language tempo heart rate. And I will feel better at 145 to 148 if I have caffeine on board than I do if I don't. Right.
So
yeah.
The average improvement in performance is about 12%.
Right. That's what I said.
Yeah.
11 to 12%. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
I know. It really is.
I mean, if you were looking to get 10% better on your bike when you're out riding your bike, or 10% better going for a walk or whatever it is that you're doing, 12% is a number.
I know.
That's a serious number.
It is.
I mean, you'd be looking at a lot of things to do that you could improve that. You know, you'd be looking at putting more wattage out, that sort of thing. Wow. 12%.
It's a lot. And if you're an amateur and, you know, nobody's clocking you, and you just want to, crush the Saturday B ride, you might as well have a cup of coffee before you go.
And then maybe put some iced coffee in your water bottle.
Yeah. Or in my case, Runa or green tea.
I know. You go a different direction.
Well, the coffee, that would hit my stomach wrong while I'm working out, to be drinking coffee while I'm actually riding. No, that would not work. I can handle tea or Runa much better.
Mm.
Yeah. It's a stomach thing.
Okay.
So, right. And I do. I like Runa in my water. Well, guayusa. That's the plant that I use. So guayusa is it's a rainforest plant, and it does have caffeine in it. And you can get, there's a brand called Runa that I get. But guayusa is a rainforest plant that does contain caffeine. And there are many plants that contain caffeine. We just happen to only regularly consume a few of them. But guayusa is one of them, and I like guayusa because... it's got that sustained energy effect. Yerba mate kind of does that too. And you can put yerba mate in your water bottle too. I found your yerba mate hit me a little too hard. So I was using it for a while and then I stopped. But I have been using guayusa in my water bottle for a couple of years now. And I like how it makes me feel. It tastes pretty earthy, so you have to get used to the taste. But I find that... It gently revs me up without overdoing it. And I'm very sensitive to caffeine. So even if I drank a whole bottle of guayusa, it would still jack me up quite a bit. Coffee can help to reduce your risk of diabetes. And if you already have diabetes, it can help to regulate your blood sugar. And so it's been repeatedly associated with a lower risk of diabetes. And and the more you drink, the better it is. So it's associated with drastically reduced risk of type 2 diabetes. And people who drink several cups a day are the least likely to become diabetic. And I believe also, if you're already diabetic, it'll help with your blood sugar. Now I don't know what happens if you put sugar in your coffee, but it probably helps.
You get another boost, I would think, right?
No, I think that putting the sugar in the coffee is not a good idea if you're trying to prevent diabetes. However,
oh, yeah, definitely, right.
However, the fact that you have the coffee on board is going to some extent, mitigate the fact that you have sugar in there. So,
right.
Also may lower your risk of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Can make you smarter in the short term, protect your brain in old age. Thank goodness. So keep drinking that coffee, Ron.
What are you trying to say?
I'm trying to say that yesterday morning I got all excited and I ran in and I said, you've got to use this old Police song next to you. What can I do? All I want is to be next to you. And we got all excited and we listened to it. And you're like, all right, I'm going to put it in my playlist. And then I asked you, I said, hey, remember that song Next to You? Guess what? The Foo Fighters and Offspring covered it. And you were like, what? Next to You? What are you talking about? And I was like, oh, my. So keep drinking that coffee.
I'll keep drinking the coffee.
Right. So Alzheimer's is the most common neurodegenerative disorder in the world and a leading cause of dementia. And coffee drinkers have a 60% lower risk of Alzheimer's and dementia. And
yes.
Parkinson's is the second most common neurodegenerative disorder and coffee lowers your risk of that, too. So it's nice. Also good for your liver. It can help to prevent cirrhosis, lowers the risk of cirrhosis by as much as 80%. So if you have a drinking problem, it's good if you also drink coffee, believe it or not.
And a 20% less chance at kidney disease.
Yeah, that's good too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So not that if you're drinking enough alcohol to potentially give yourself cirrhosis, you should do something about that. But if you're working on your drinking problem, then drink coffee and mm-hmm. drink good coffee. Drink good, good quality coffee that's organic, antioxidants. It's going to lower your risk of liver disease. May decrease your risk of premature death. And a lot of people still think that coffee is unhealthy. But the actual studies say that if you drink coffee, you're likely to live longer. It lowers risk of death from all causes. It's really interesting. I wonder how that works for people like me with the caffeine problem. Maybe if I find my sweet spot on caffeine, though, it's all right.
Well, it's primarily enhances endurance exercise, not short sprints.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
That's something I read.
Because it releases free fatty acids, so it's going to make it so that your fat adaptation is better.
Right.
Yes.
And then here's from the International Olympic Committee. They currently list caffeine as a restricted drug. Restricted. Okay. But here's the deal. What it means is approximately 1,000 milligrams of coffee, or about 8 cups of coffee, would be required to exceed the current IOC limit. But it's important to note that people can metabolize caffeine in very different rates.
That's right. And that would be me. I metabolize it like, it's stupid. So that's the only thing. If you can have health concerns that make coffee bad for you. Some people will get more migraines if they drink caffeine. I don't generally get headaches, but if I have too much caffeine, I will get headaches. I may get achier if I have too much caffeine. And I have minor heart rhythm issues, and those are enhanced by having too much caffeine. So you have to be careful of stuff like that. And coffee, I like this sentence here. Coffee isn't just black water. Oh, black water, keep on rolling, miss.
If it moves,
keep on.
Right. I knew a song was coming from this.
But it's not just black water. It's got some pantothenic acid and riboflavin, niacin and thiamine, nice B vitamins, some potassium. I mean, it's not a lot of stuff, but it adds up if you drink a lot of coffee.
And so you slow metabolizer too, just to keep this in effect. Some athletes have come close to flunking the drug test after ingesting only 350 milligrams of coffee.
See,
that would be the slow metabolizer.
See, 350 milligrams of coffee, of caffeine, is going to give me a massive headache. I can't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I
mean, I had a nice coffee yesterday, and I put in mostly decaf, and that was good.
When was the last time you even considered drinking 8 cups of coffee? I mean, I love my coffee, but I'm not going to drink 8 cups of coffee. That's a lot of coffee.
No, I drank, well, I guess that time when we were in that nice cafe in Allentown, New Jersey, I had one full cup plus one cup of decaf because it was really good. Yeah, I had 16 ounces, and that included 8 ounces of full-strength coffee, which was a lot for me. And I paid for it. I didn't feel well for a couple of days. And what happens to me is I get very tired and very achy. And, you know, it's just too much for me. Because I think, you know, you suppress that adenosine. And then when the adenosine comes back on board, my neurotransmitters just tank. And it's not good. So.
I have to also comment here that giving Fran coffee, enough caffeine to really send her off the edge, is a very entertaining
endeavor. give me chai or guayusa or too much chocolate will do the same thing for you.
Oh my God, you just
bounced. By the way, coffee has a lot of antioxidants in it. so that's the thing that it has the most of. It has a lot of antioxidants, and that's probably the mechanism. Well, the way that it helps with the blood sugar is because it improves liver function. So because it's a cholagogue and a choleretic, it moves bile through your liver. So your liver processes are going to happen more efficiently. And also there's a lot of antioxidants, and antioxidants generally help with blood sugar regulation and help to prevent damage from high amounts of blood sugar. So the liver is going to be healthier if there's coffee in it because of the antioxidants. And that's probably one of the mechanisms by which it prevents cirrhosis, because cirrhosis, you're putting the alcohol through, the alcohol's going through, and it's being acted upon by alcohol dehydrogenase. You're getting your aldehydes, and the aldehydes are unstable. They have free radical damage. So the cells of the liver are going to then try to repair those free radicals, and now that's where you start to get your breakdown of tissue and your cirrhosis. So if you've got lots of antioxidants on board, you're going to protect that from happening. So if you're a heavy drinker, it's good to drink coffee too. But it's also good to not be a heavy drinker. So think about that. So coffee in moderation, just like anything else, coffee in moderation is good for you. And to figure out the amount of coffee that works for you, you have to figure that out for yourself. Now, if somebody like me, I probably could do without it. But I have a little bit of it because I like it. And I just have to watch how much caffeine goes in, because if I get too much caffeine on board, I don't feel well. So when I go to the cafe, I may start doing 3/4 decaf and 1/4 caf, and I'll feel better that way. All right. So that was fun. All right. That was fun. That's enough stuff for this week. All right. So you have been listening to Radio Naturopath. This is a call and talk show about health and natural medicine. I'm Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org or iTunes. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram, @FranStorchND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. Remember to eat your veggies. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM WHUS Stores, where our special guest will be Jessica Tracy with a special fitness event.